Pancreatic cancer? How do you cure pancreatic cancer? HIV? How do you cure people with HIV? Well, today we're going to be talking about two different ways to treat disease. One is the creation of vaccines. The other is what is called immunotherapy. And to help us through this sort of very interesting and important area, we have Professor Kathy Yao from the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And Kathy Yao, welcome to Science Studio. We're looking forward to this.
So we'd like to ask you, how did you get interested in science?
Oh, science. Yes. I came from China. I'm an immigrant, right?
Were you educated in China or
in
here?
In China, yeah.
Okay.
I got my MD degree from China.
Okay.
And I then went on to science research because I got interested in this vaccine, the microbiology area. So at that time, the monoclonal antibody is like a really hot, it's just for the treatment and all that. But at that time, China's condition wasn't the optimal for cell culture and everything. So I really had a hard time to produce the monoclonal antibody. And then I found a Dr. Epi Rao. He's working on immunology. At the
University of Texas at El Paso.
Yes. That was really amazing, right? It's like a connection there from China to here, to UTEP. And Dr. Rao sent me some protein, purified proteins that I can work on in China. And later on, I came over to work, for...
But, you just said something interesting. You were first an MD.
Yeah, yeah.
And then now a scientist or... Researcher.
PhD, yeah. It's a medical-related area was my background.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking that is that when I grew up and I had a chance to go to medical school, and I just didn't want to do it. I wanted to be a scientist. And I have a lot of students. We both have science, and they have to make a choice between being a doctor and being a researcher. What do you tell them? I know what I tell them, but I'd like to know what you tell
them. Where your passion is, right?
Yes, exactly.
So I wanted, when I see the patient, I wanted to understand what's going on. Why is that? How can we get some better treatment? Because we know a lot of disease, there's no treatment or no good treatment for that. And I always wanted to research on that. That's how I get into the research area.
Yeah, I agree with you, the passion. I always tell them, you want to help people, can be a doctor if you want to ask questions, like you'd be a scientist.
Right.
But don't become a doctor because your grandmother said that's what to do. Do your passion.
Right, right, yeah. Because I found lots of enjoyment in the research, something that I designed and my rationale and all that, it turned out to be right. That's the enjoying moment for me.
The feature, though, that about being an MD is the fact that you, on a daily basis, meet people who need help. When you're a researcher, you're usually quite a long way from the people who need the help. Now, in your current position, you managed to get some patient interactions as well as the basic research?
Yeah, we're trying to do translational research.
Right.
So all the vaccines that we develop and the immunotherapy, we wanted to get to the clinical trials.
Okay.
So I have a close collaboration with a surgeon who is in the pancreatic cancer, right. The general surgeon. So we analyze the tissues that he got
so from the patient. It's a personal, you're looking at the DNA of the particular patient.
Yeah, the patients, right. What molecules in there, and then we develop something specific for these population, and we're trying to see in the clinical trial whether we can get some improvement.
I got it. Before we get into the details of that, let's just run through a few sort of definitions for the audience.
Okay.
So a vaccine and the development of a vaccine, in your case for HIV. Tell us how a vaccine works and what are the problems in trying to create a vaccine for HIV?
Yeah, so vaccine is something that you immunize with, right? That's something that you didn't see before, but you immunize and then...
Prevents the infection.
Your body will generate some antibodies and something ready there if they seize the bug to infect the next time, then they will kill the HIV or something like that.
So,
a general term, I guess.
One can understand, up to a certain point, that you've got a bacterial thing, that therefore you inject a very mild form of the bacteria to the patient, generates the understanding that this is not something good, so there's a memory induced.
Right. Uh-huh.
But in terms of a virus, how do you go about introducing the virus into the body such that the body can then react to it next time it sees it?
there are several different forms of vaccines. Protein vaccine, that's the major, right, a lot of vaccine were developed by the protein subunit vaccine. But that one can only induce antibody response. So that will prevent some virus like, I guess, rabies and those.
So it says, okay, here's a bad invader, send out some antivirus to kill it.
Yeah, so you immunize with this protein with adjuvant, and then you generate antibodies that recognize this specific pathogen.
Right.
So next time when that got infected and your memory response comes back and then produce massive amount of the antibody. But a lot of virus, they infect the cells. So they get into the cells, the antibody cannot kill. So we want cellular immune responses so that two arms of immune, the armies, one is antibody, one is the cellular immune response. So these are T cells, CD8 positive T cells. Those T cells recognize virus infected cells, then kill those cells. So antibody is the first line of defense, and then CTL is the second line to kill that. So for HIV especially, because the genome incorporated into the T cells and they stay there. So we wanted to kill those cells, get rid of the virus, the residual virus. The difficulties for HIV comes in because the viral genome integrates into the cells. So they stay there all the time.
So it's a living cell that has the bad information in it that's hanging around.
Yeah, yeah. So if you want to get rid of that cell, the CTL must come over to kill the infected cells. And for HIV, another thing is this envelope protein. It's a weak antigen. So,
what do you mean by an envelope? This is something that is encasing. Explain a little bit more detail.
Okay.
It's an envelope.
So it's a virus structure.
Right.
The virus is around with the cell membrane on the surface, but on the surface there's a protrusion of a protein, and that's we call it envelope. The envelope has its own structure, like a trimeric structure with special conformation, and that binds to the CD4 cells so that it can get infected into the cells. So this envelope, usually if it's a pathogen, these envelope is like a strong foreign thing for the body, and then it's easy to get the antibody response.
Right.
But this HIV, this is a weak. It's really hard to get antibody against this envelope.
Because its structure is so similar to other structures in the body? Or
We don't know, because different viruses have different thing. And also that mutates. This envelope mutates a lot. They change.
It still does the same function.
Yeah, but they change their conformation, change their amino acid composition, and then they change the conformation.
Really, to protect themselves from antibodies and whatever else.
Yeah, yeah.
There.
So you just can't catch them next time.
So this is rather like, you know, the redcoats of the British Army fighting against the gorillas, you know. If the gorillas are constantly changing their location, as Chairman Mao said,
right.
You know, live off of the population, live off the people, right?
Right. So these are like a virus are very clever to generate lots of things to evade the immune system in the human. So this is a lot of good examples. So their envelope change and their CTL is like they recognize the cellular immune response, like those cells that can kill the HIV-infected cells. Those epitopes change as well. So those cells that can kill those infected cells before, later on, they can't do that anymore.
So it's a little bit like selective evolution. These things are evolving to protect themselves, and you're evolving something to get rid of them. And
yeah, so it's like a constant battle between like humans and the virus's intelligence.
So, I mean, the sort of a conclusion to that brief discussion is that, okay, you get a particular vaccine, but it's got very limited time horizons.
I think one thing to follow up with basically key statement there is, you know, every child gets vaccinated for common things and they last a lifetime. But with the HIV, it's more of a fight. And I think that's because these T cells are involved in these envelopes you're talking about. So maybe you could make a distinction between a vaccine that a child gets when he's one or two and this work.
Some virus, their protein can generate like long-term memory cells.
So one is bacterial and one is viral. Is really the viruses are more difficult than the bacteria, or
no, not necessarily. It depends on each specific species, which one. Like there are lots of difficulties to get a vaccine against the Staph aureus. They change also, so it's not the bacteria and the virus issue. It's individual's issue. For some virus like measles, the mumps, and those are easy to get memory T cells, B cells. So easy to that's a, like a lifelong immune.
Yeah, that's my question really. Why are some lifelong and some so difficult?
That's a million-dollar question.
Well, I mean, that is exactly as Russell said. That's an evolutionary feature. And those particular species will be gone in 100 years. Right. They won't survive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they mutate to something else to get you. You have new problem there.
Well, I mean, tuberculosis is a classic case because my stepmother had TB when I was very young. I got this BCG, I think it was, called vaccination.
Yeah, everybody.
Right. Yeah. Everybody gets that?
Well, now, not, but yeah, in our generation.
Back, yeah, yes. I certainly remember having it. And now, of course, there are just new forms of TB, which are resistant to, first of all, the vaccination, and then a whole swath of drugs.
Yeah.
You know, so this evolution is that the things that die off get, unfortunately, replaced by nastier relatives. So anyway, that's one of the areas you're trying to work on, and we'll come back to that in a moment.
Okay.
So this is sort of a prophylactic sort of
prevention
approach to disease.
Yeah.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Kathy Yao, who is a professor of microbiology at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. We're talking about all sorts of things, vaccines, immunotherapy, which is coming up after this break.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. A wife and mother of two, Jan Scheuermann gets help these days from Hector. Just simple things, really, such as sorting and putting things away.
Hector, hovering next to her, does her bidding, not by listening, but by reading her thoughts. Hector, a nickname coined by Jan, is the most advanced robotic arm today. And Jan, a decade-long quadriplegic, can once again feed herself a bite of chocolate.
Unlike previous brain-computer interface robotic arms where the user must think out each movement, Jan just has to think, for example, put the ball in the box, and the arm executes nearly simultaneously.
First, surgeons implanted in Jan's brain two tiny electrode chips, each with dozens of hair-thin contacts. The electrodes picked up individual neurons' impulses as Jan imagined moving her hand and arm in certain motions.
Then the software algorithm, which is key to this study's success, matched the neurons' firing patterns to certain movements.
Researchers wrote the computer program based on years of studying how primates' brains controlled hand movements. The result is an unprecedented algorithm that closely resembles our brain's process as it controls the upper limbs. So intuitive is the program that Jan began calling the robot her arm.
The arm is not physically attached to her, but to the computer, which also has cables running to plugs on Jan's head. Plus, everything is happening in a lab.
Even though Jan can't take home the arm and is constantly tweaked, this study moves the field a giant step ahead. Consider less than a decade ago, the brain-computer interface merely allowed users to move cursors on a computer screen.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Kathy Yao from the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And we're going to be talking a little bit, following up on the vaccine work you're doing, about the immunotherapy. Now, just tell us the distinction. Vaccination is a prophylactic. You don't have the disease, and hopefully you'll get it. Immunotherapy is when you've got the damn disease, and now you want to get rid of it. So what are you looking at in that area?
So there's two different areas. Like a virus infection, you can prevent. For cancer, since we don't know the cause, many causes of a cancer, so it's hard to predict which population to vaccinate against. So usually when they
but
have
the
a
implication is that the cancers are caused by viruses or organisms too?
There's some, like a papillomavirus causes cervical cancer. Those are the vaccines, the preventive vaccine that's already developed. But a lot of cancers, we don't know the causes of that. And then these, we will see the cancer first. Then we'll try to cure the cancer. Of course, right now, the first thing to cure the cancer is the surgery to remove the cancer. But lots, when diagnosed, they're already metastasis to the you know, remote place where you don't know. And now here, the immunotherapy is really a gold standard to come in to try to hunt down those metastasized cells and try to kill those cells.
Okay.
So that's where I come in with the similar concept like a virus, using your own immune system to create some armies like an antibodies and CTLs, like cellular cytotoxic T cells.
So let me just interject then.
Right.
So pancreatic cancer, when it metastasizes and you've got, as you put it, cells in remote locations, you can isolate those cells with your colleagues in surgery, get the particular cell that's in that particular person. Is that cell going to be very distinctive than it would be if it was in Russell or myself or yourself?
It depends. Like different people, for cancer-specific antigens, there are many, many cancer-specific antigens. And right now, we don't know which one is major, which one is the minor, which
no, but
one.
What I meant was that if you isolate a cancer cell of specifically pancreatic cancer in different patients, there are significant differences between the genetic makeup of those cells
mm-hmm.
based upon the host, that is the person.
Right.
Okay, I mean, that's a fact.
Yes, that's
a fact. So that's how you can then begin to think about individual immunotherapy.
Right. It's called personalized,
right.
Medicine.
So we each have a stamp when we have pancreatic cancer. It says that belongs to you or me.
Yeah. But different people have different makeup of those antigens overexpression. And like which one do we target to and which one we go after. That's
okay.
Quite different because like therapy, some people respond, some people don't. And they have difference in there. And we got to find out first.
I mean, I had a good friend that died of pancreatic cancer a few years ago. How successful is it right now? Is this something where you have to go through clinical trials or how is it working?
Well, right now, over the last two decades, the cure rate for pancreatic cancer hasn't been improved. So that's something really devastating. Once you're diagnosed, there's no...
You're saying there's no hope, really, if you get pancreatic.
But now with all these research in the clinical trials, we have some hope there. So we run different clinical trials targeting to different markers. Some are showing really remarkable response.
Tell us exactly how you now go about this particular immunotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a patient. You'll be able to get the cells. You can begin to investigate the cells, look at their genetic makeup. Then what do you do?
Our approach is using the virus-like particle. So it looks like virus because we know virus is a really good immunogen for body to recognize that's a foreigner. So we analyze the patient samples to characterize some specific antigens that overexpressed on these patients. And we take this antigen to put on surface of our virus-like particles. So these virus is called chimeric virus-like particles, and you put something there that overexpressed in this patient, and then we'll immunize this patient. Those patients will generate immune response against this protein that overexpressed, that causing the cancer to spread and all that. So then they can get their own immune system to act up and go after these cancer cells.
Okay. So then most of these cancers, once you've got to the stage of the patients that you see, there's not a lot of time.
Right.
So once you get the cancer cell of a particular patient and begin to do your investigation, how long does it take to be able to do this analysis and then put on your chimera?
Those process are not very long. You think it's very long, but not very long.
A couple of weeks or something like that?
Yeah, a couple of weeks. And we can get the analyze and then the particles ready. And then, of course, we have to go through all these FDA, you know, requirements.
Yeah, that's my next question, because it seems to me, with my own experience, a person has pancreatic cancer and they're running out of hope. Can they come to you and get treated?
We can only do that whenever there is a clinical trial approved by the FDA that we can run in the clinics. Right now, our therapy hasn't been gone through that process yet. We're still in the preclinical stage. But we have several trials ongoing, like KRAS mutation and antibodies against the mesothelin.
So if somebody has pancreatic cancer, they can't try it. To get the FDA approval, and what I'm trying to understand is, I know that in some cases where people are desperate, they can be treated without a clinical trial.
Yeah, but the response rate is pretty low right now. Gemcitabine is the first-line treatment. Lots of people don't respond to that. And that's why we have a research on looking at why the pancreatic cancer cells are resistant, so we can get rid of that molecule that resistant to the chemotherapy, and then we can do the combination therapy. A lot of those are still in the preclinical stage. To go through the clinical trial, and that takes time as well. What I meant is when we have some study, say we knock out some of the genes, we have clinical trial approved vector that we can put that molecule in, the shRNA, which is a knock down that molecule in, that can be go through the clinical trial. We can go through like a phase one clinical trial, and we're working on that as well. So we have different layers of, you know, the translational research and immunotherapy and gene therapy type of thing. Gene therapy is like you introduce some genes in which was low in the pancreatic cancer. You wanted to knock it down, something that overexpressed in the cancer. You want to knock down that. So I believe it's a combination therapy. It's not just like one therapy will cure pancreatic cancer. Gene therapy, you know, the chemotherapy and immunotherapy, like a combination will do it.
Let's talk a little bit from your perspective as someone that spends a lifetime and a career thinking about disease, thinking about cancer, thinking about viral infections. Tell us why you think that there's such an increase in cancer over the last, let's say, 50 years. Obviously, there are things like smoking, and that's a particular cancer. But in general, there seems to be more and more cancers being discovered and a bigger percentage of the population. I'd like your ideas about why. Is this just because we're living longer? Or is this environmental? Or is it the food that we eat is no longer quite what it was? Well, you know, what is the sort of general feeling for the experts in the field about this?
Well, it's really hard to answer that question. I think it's a combination thing. Environment, of course, especially, say, like in China, certain places, the water, air pollution, and the food.
Right.
That's something. And also, it depends on particular cancer, different cancer. Like a pancreatic cancer, people have some list of like cause, maybe something. Say like smoking and drinking, some meat, red meat, maybe related.
Well, you say maybe. I mean, I know it's all a statistical analysis,
right.
But I mean, do you eat red meat?
I still do.
Okay. Do you smoke? No.
No.
Do you drink?
No.
Oh, no, you don't? Well,
a little bit. When you say drink, it's like...
Yeah, not to excess.
Heavy, yeah.
Therapeutic.
I mean, red wine is good for the heart.
Yes. Yeah. We did that study as well. It's like antioxidant.
Right. Let me ask a related question. You know, could you tell us a little bit more what techniques you actually use to identify the bad actors? When you go into the laboratory and you're taking some samples, what do you actually do?
We have several levels. From RNA level, we do microarray analysis.
And that means what?
Microarray is you have cancer sample and the pancreatitis, chronic pancreatitis, and normal pancreas. And then you extract their RNA and you run on a chip where you have those primers to amplify the genes, and it's like a thousand of genes. Right. Then after that, you analyze like how much fold of difference in the cancer versus the pancreatitis or normal, upregulation or downregulation, and which have tons of genes upregulated right. or downregulated.
And that sounds like a very time, you know, intensive, but I gather it's not. Again, we've got so clever at
yeah,
amplifying
a lot
genetic
of,
material.
Yeah, it can be run like really fast.
Right.
But you have to validate those things.
You mean you have to have control? What do you mean
you
by
validate? You use different methods.
Reproducibility?
Oh. Different method. This is one method. Each method have some limitations to get false positive and false negative, so those things.
So in general, because that intrigues me. Okay, you've got a healthy pancreas. You've got pancreatitis, which I'm not quite sure what that means. And then you've got the cancer. What have you beginning to see? There's the difference between, let's say, the pancreatitis. What's the difference between pancreatitis and pancreatic cancer in terms of that type of an assay?
This is just like a control.
Yeah, I know, but that means
you see
pancreatitis is en route to pancreatic cancer. That's what I was trying to get at.
No, there are some reporters saying that. Some are not supporting that. So still now is not a conclusion. Like you get chronic pancreatitis, you'll get the cancer.
So you don't see some genetic amplification in pancreatitis, for example, that you see fully developed in pancreatic cancer, something like that.
Sometimes you do see some genes are in the pancreatitis, they're in the cancer. Sometimes you don't see that.
So we're very early stages of all of this.
Yeah. I mean, there's a group who are talking about like induce of pancreatitis, and that leads to pancreatic cancer, because we know this is all pro-inflammatory disease that contributes.
So what does that mean for our audience? Pancreatitis means your pancreas is inflamed and it hurts, or?
Yeah, they're acute and chronic. It's just like cytokines, I think, cytokine storm, those kind of things that your pancreas is inflamed. Then later on, you can get controlled. Pancreatic cancer, majority are ductal, PDACs.
Sorry, we wouldn't understand that. Just summarize for a lay person what the difference is between pancreatitis when you look at the pancreas and when you look at the cells and full-blown pancreatic cancer.
If you see the duct in the pancreatitis, that's small. And if you see that in the pancreatic cancer, that's like a distorted. And
so it's a visual look at the ducts.
Yeah, for the histology to diagnose whether this is a pancreatic cancer or pancreatitis.
Is it clear? Is it simple?
Yeah.
Can you be confused?
Sometimes the diagnosis is turn out to be really difficult.
Yeah.
And it could be some, you know, misdiagnosed.
Kathy Yao, Baylor College of Medicine, thank you very much for being here with us today. It's been a great pleasure.
And thank you very much for your work helping people. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And we will be back next week. Bye-bye.
With your Synapse Flash. El Paso County Commissioners approved $152 million worth of bonds recently. The bonds will help University Medical Center build new clinics and renovate existing ones. Several groups opposed UMC's plan, including members of the El Paso County Medical Society. Read UMC's point-by-point response to the Medical Society at Synapse. Go to mcasynapse.org.